Welcome to Refugee Radio.
Welcome to the Refugee Radio Show. In this programme, we will be speaking to the writer and activist Kate Adams prior to a public reading in Brighton from her new book of poetry. The work is inspired by her experience of volunteering with refugees and asylum seekers imprisoned in the Immigration Detention Centre in Dover. We will also be hearing from local people who volunteer as visitors to people in detention centres in Gatwick. The scale of immigration detention in the UK is huge, with 30,000 people imprisoned every year, including around 2,000 children. Anyone who claims asylum in the UK can be locked up and detained at any time, often for little or no reason. Some of the people who are detained are those who have committed crimes such as using fake immigration papers, but many others are individuals and families whose asylum claims were refused. Many of the people detained are young, vulnerable, they're away from home and their homeland, they're away from their culture and religion and language, and they're imprisoned in a system that they do not understand. They're not like the people who are serving custodial sentences in normal prisons. They don't know how long they will be held, and they do not know if they will ever be released or what will happen. Many detainees have no legal representation, no solicitor. This means that they can't access bail procedures, for example. A BID survey in 2011 found that 49% had no legal advisor. Many of the detainees have suffered violence, war, or even torture in their home countries. The experience of being locked up indefinitely, in our experience, can lead to mental health issues, self-harm, and suicide. In the local area, we have Tinsley House near Gatwick Airport. It's a detention centre with a capacity of 150 detainees and four families housed in a separate unit. This bearing in mind the Conservative election promise to end child detention. Tinsley House Detention Centre is effectively a prison. It is run for profit by the private multinational security firm Group 4 Security, or G4S. There is also another place locally called Brook House. This is much bigger and can hold up to 426 people. Brook House is also run by G4S for profit. This is a much higher security facility with much longer periods of detention. There are few official records of how long people are detained, but a recent inspection of Colnbrook near Heathrow found 25% of the detainees there had been there longer than a year.
My name's Kate Adams, and I'm a volunteer caseworker for Kent Refugee Help. I've just recently had a book of poems published called The Cheering Rain by Conversation Paper Press. And the poems were really inspired by my work with immigration detainees in Dover Immigration Removal Centre. I work as a volunteer caseworker for a small charity, Kent Refugee Help. And that charity was set up by local people who were concerned about people being detained for indefinite amounts of time. And we collected money to stand bail for people and persuaded people to stand, to be sureties. And then, because there was so much extra work to do when people were released and so much support work doing, we got registered as a charity and then got some money for a caseworker, who's a part-time caseworker, who goes and visits people, assesses their situation. And I also support him as a volunteer, but I was kind of one of the founding members. And that's how I became a worker for Kent Refugee Help, a voluntary worker.
And how does being a caseworker sort of lead into to the poetry? Is that your response to the people and situations, or was it part of your role to respond artistically to what was happening?
Well, I suppose I've always been interested in the arts. Like, my first degree was in fine art. I've always loved writing, but I've never found a way to express myself that I was kind of happy with. And I didn't actually feel I was a poet, because I couldn't write in formal sort of meter. But at the point I started doing the casework, I started hearing stories from people and really connecting with them. Previously, I've been doing a lot of on-the-streets campaigning, trying to stop deportations. But through the casework, I was seeing people very frequently and hearing a lot about their stories, taking that down factually. But then besides recording those facts, there would be something emotional going on, which I sort of, and I real, sort of feel the poetry reaches for that. It's something beside fact. It's what I call an emotional truth, in a way, which is different from the facts, you know. It's about people's experiences and feelings about them. And some of the cases I was involved in were so distressing that I started to write to kind of release myself, in a way. I'm supporting kind of prisoners, but I'm having to release myself from that experience.
There's something that therapists who work with refugees who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder call second-hand post-traumatic stress disorder, which is the sort of the negative psychological toll it takes of working with people who have been traumatised and sharing those experiences with them. That, you know, obviously you've not been through the experience that they've been through, but just through sharing it with them, hearing it, trying to help them come to terms with it and supporting them, it can add up on the person. You need somewhere to kind of put that stuff. So the poetry has offered that to you.
It was a kind of release, but also it was a very positive thing for me, because I was writing, which was something I'd wanted to do for so long, and I'd always been loaded down with writing reports and press releases, supporting letters. And I started going to a poetry group, and I said, I'm not sure this is poetry. And the guy running the group said, he loved it. He said, you're a writer, and you're going to get published. And I didn't kind of believe him, but... So it kind of validated a part of me that was kind of hidden, which was great. And as a result of that, I also applied to do a year at the Refugee Therapy Centre, studying, it was a foundation course in counselling. And I wasn't really interested in being a counsellor as such. I was just more interested in looking at the mental health of people who are refugees and understanding more about that, and that kind of helping my writing in a way.
That's
so I did that too.
And this you've mentioned twice this idea that you weren't sure if it was poetry, or that you didn't think you could do poetry. Is there something about poetry which is a bit off-putting to people? They think, oh, it's something you can do, there's a proper way of doing it, and what I'm doing might not be right somehow.
Or... It's something you learn at school.
Yeah, school's to blame, I think.
You have to recite. Yeah. You have to learn to recite poetry, learn it by heart.
They manage to kill a lot of stuff, don't they, at school, yeah.
And it was different from what I was interested in doing, which was telling a story, really. I've always been interested in telling a story, and I think because I trained as a painter, I was interested in telling a story through images as well, and colours, and atmosphere. And so those were the things that poetry allowed me to do. What I couldn't do was this mathematical thing of getting a line a certain length, you know. But this guy who was running the poetry group in Canterbury, although he actually excelled in this kind of thing, he said, it doesn't matter with your work. It's free verse, and that's, you're a narrative poet. And the people who published me, Conversation Paper Press, they're a small collective. They're interested in the poet as an activist, and they're looking at work which sort of breaks boundaries, and they've published work from people in countries where it's difficult to publish, like Turkey and parts of Africa. And so they're interested in my work because of, you know, the refugee connection. And so I found someone that validates the way I write, which is great.
And you said that it's narrative poetry. So you're telling. Is it sort of a straight? Somebody tells you their story, and then you kind of are telling the whole. Do you try to tell sort of beginning, middle, and end of it, or are these snapshots, or how does it work in terms of being a storytelling exercise?
I was doing an interview, and someone said to me in the interview, how much of this is about you, and how much of it is about the people that, you know, you're actually telling the story of. And I don't set out to really tell a story. And some of the people might have a very compelling story, but it's much more of whether I connected with a particular person, and almost the way they told what was happening to them, their language, their use of their own language and of broken English, the images they use, which would be different from mine maybe, and how that then sort of resonated with me. And so, and then my reaction to that. So it's a kind of colliding of two worlds, really.
So you're trying to capture this, the English, you know, because people from different countries that don't, that are non-native English speakers, they have different ways of phrasing things, the sort of grammatic, you know, grammatic inconsistencies that are perhaps
beautiful
from their native tongue, but yeah, aren't the way we'd say something. So you like those, capturing those nuances?
Yeah. Well, they would stay in my head sometimes.
Yeah.
The voice of the person would stay in my head.
Yeah,
what they had to say was so powerful, I would have to write it down.
Mm.
And it's actually the person who really, the person I was helping, who really initiated and sparked off my poems, was someone who was actually silenced by immigration detention and became mute and stopped speaking. And I used to write letters to him, which were translated by a fellow detainee into Darija, which is kind of Arabic street language. And I wrote a poem about the moment he started speaking to me. I got a telephone call from him when he'd been transferred into a psychiatric unit. And that, you know, that poem, it's quite a simple poem, but it still reminds me of that experience.
Yeah, that's very powerful.
Yeah.
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 I once knew somebody who was catatonic and mute from their traumatic experiences as well. It's really difficult to get them legal representation or advocate for them in medical setting because they couldn't speak. They literally didn't have a voice. Yeah.
Yes,
and
that's right.
That's what Refugee Radio is all about. It's about helping people to have a voice. And yeah, it is. You do come across people that they actually literally can't speak because of what's happened.
They shut down. Yeah. Yeah.
And so then you became the voice, the conduit for this.
Yes, well, in fact, the other thing is that he gave me a voice, actually, because he helped to release my poetry, the kind of connection between us. And, you know, seven years later, I'm still close to him. He's still waiting for a decision on his case. I'm still kind of experiencing some of the pain that he's experiencing in a way. But that connection was so important, you know. I've got him to thank, really, for so many things.
So it's a two-way exchange.
Yeah, it's an exchange. I think, like everything that works out well in life, it's always an exchange, isn't it?
Can you tell me a little bit about Conversation Paper Press?
Yeah.
The people who publish it. They also publish work from other countries.
Yes. I mean, they're totally unfunded. They don't have any kind of grant. They put their own money into the press, and they break even by selling books. And then that will fund the next book, or that will keep a book going.
Right.
What my charity has been doing is buying the books in bulk from them, so they get something, and we get the books a little bit cheaper. We sell them, and then all the money that we get goes back into the charity, and a lot of that money goes directly to immigration detainees or former detainees.
Detention. And one of the things about visiting people in detention, and many people in the public might not know, is like, for example, the UKVA is trying to show us that people who are in detention is like, it's not the same like people being in a prison, for example, and it's two different things. But one of the things that UK, for example, that is doing that is very different than other countries in the European Union is that in the UK, people can be indefinitely remain in a detention center, which means that when they go inside, they will never know when they might be out. The European Union directive says that no one should be in detention more than 18 months, and the UK is one of the three countries, actually, of the European Union who is extending that time. Italy has recently said that they are going to detain people more than 18 months. And for example, in Spain now, one of the things that came out, like for example, when people were put in detention center in Spain, they were never told when they were going to be deported back. Suddenly the police were going into the room, they were taking them out, they were put in the plane. So they had no time to call anyone, to call to the family, they were not given even the right to make a phone call. And that has changed now. The three judges have said that everyone should be given 72 hours notice before they are deported back. One of the things in the detention centers that also is very different than in prison is like, in prison, many people, the people I met that they have been detained in the detention center, they keep asking me, you know, they are treating me like if I was a criminal. When I was in prison, as minimum I knew why I was in here. You know, maybe I stole something, maybe I did something wrong or something what might be considered as criminal. I had a criminal charge. So when I came inside the prison, I knew I was going to stay for 1-2 years, so 10 years. But now in detention center, I have no clue what is going to happen. I have no clue what is going to be my future. I don't even know what is going to happen once I come back to the country. So many people who are in the detention center, they really say sometimes, you know, I wish I could go to prison because as minimum I know what kind of future I'm going to have. It's very hard actually to explain about what is the meaning of detention because to me, I've been doing this for 3 years now and I've been meeting people from Sri Lanka, Afghanistan, people from Nigeria, people that I know once they were deported back, they tried to kill them again. So it's very difficult to go into the detention place and see these
also
people
things that are like frustrating
is about
like, oh,
there is something called the Rule 35 that says that
people,
anyone who has been tortured should never be detained.
Them.
In the UK,
so it's very difficult
but most
people
of the people
kind of
who are in detention
center,
about
they have suffered torture
personally.
The problem
the,
is, like, for example, if torture
thing.
Has been done in the genital areas, they have no scars to show it. And then unless the torture has been like proper, let's say broken bones, the scars do disappear after a few years. So again, many people after like say 5-6 years, there is not even evidence about maybe the torture physically they suffer. So that is one of the big struggle we face when we support people in detention. The impact on detainees is like horrendous. I have seen someone being at the detention center and after 1 week to be dead and be released, he had completely lost his mind. Because it's terrible, you know, people go there, they don't really know what is going to happen to them. And people go down the hill mentally. I mean, the impact on the individual is quite extreme. Mentally, people do get quite depressed. People do self-harming. People try to kill themselves. Some people are in suicidal watch for days, weeks, or in self-harming also watch. And also it's the impact on the families and the communities. So yeah, when I go to visit people in detention center, I see constantly like women crying because like in Brook House is men. And you know, most of the people who go there will be the brothers, the sisters, the mothers. I have met mothers crying, you know, this woman was desperate crying. My son is going to be deported tomorrow, he's 20. He's from Iraq, he's going to be killed. And I didn't know what to say. All I could say was like, you just have 2 hours visiting time. Put yourself together, go in, visit him, because it might be the last 2 hours, as you say, you might see your son alive. So that is what really means detention, actually, that we don't really know sometimes, well, actually, we know that sometimes when people are deported that they will be killed, and it's not much. We can do sometimes to release them. That's why we are doing the job we are doing. A bit of the numbers about, like, for example, self-harming. In just 3 months from June to March this year, in like, for example, Brook House, which is one of the detention centers close at Gatwick, 93 people did self-harm themselves. So I think that is really, really expressed how people feel inside the detention center. The total number on those months were 466. People in whole UK that do self-harm in 3 months. The UK can detain 3,500 people in any time. And last year there were 26,000 people detained. The number was a bit slower than previous year, but more or less it's around 26, 27, 28. Thank you.
Just to say a little bit about how the poetry book came to be. I've always kind of been interested in the arts, and I actually started off as a painter. That was my training, because I was no good at exams and things. I couldn't get to university, so I was really an artist. But then I became a social worker. Then I had I was struck down by ME, a mental illness, and I became disabled and had to give up my job and was using a wheelchair. And I was very much involved in the disabled people's rights struggles for a long time. But then actually, as people do for a better life, migrated to Whitstable by the sea because my health just wasn't improving. And at that, shortly after I moved there, a young offenders unit in Dover, in that dreadful Napoleonic fort that you've seen in the film, was converted into a detention centre. It was 2002. And I was well enough then to start visiting people as part of a visitor group, but also I was involved in campaigning against the detention centre and helping to run anti-deportation campaigns and that kind of thing. And I think that whole thing about being disabled made me understand about the marginalisation of people, because I lost so much through that, and I was completely kind of isolated by my illness and disbelieved. And that struggle that we had to get on buses and to get benefits and stuff is exactly, you know, it's the same struggle really as the migrants and the refugees are happening. And I was a prisoner in my house for a long time. So kind of there was a lot in there that was waiting to come out. But all my writing was very much focused on writing leaflets and press releases and articles and that kind of thing. And I never really thought I was a poet, and I went to a poetry class and felt I couldn't write poetry because I couldn't write classical poetry and I couldn't write in metre and scan. But then, so I thought, well, I'm no good at that. But then what happened was the kind of collective that was standing bail for people, helping people get out of detention, which was a kind of just done as a voluntary thing with no funding from local people. We decided to get registered as a charity and try and get casework, as I've said. And at that, or just before that point, I was doing the casework, really, and working with people quite intensively and hearing their stories and supporting them after they got out of detention as well. And it was really that that triggered off the poems. And there was one particular situation where I was telling Stephen about this in an interview. A young Algerian man I was working with, he just stopped talking, he became mute. He was sent from Dover because he was agitating and angry to Colnbrook, terrible detention centre at Heathrow. And he just faded out really and stopped speaking for 6 weeks. And he also totally neglected his personal care. It was a kind of like dirty protest in a way, a kind of silent protest. That was all he had, you know. And I was so distressed that I couldn't communicate with him that I started writing poems about him. And he really, through his silence, gave me a voice. And so I was writing these poems, and then I started going to a poetry group, which was just a loose sort of group of people connecting in Canterbury. And the guy who was running it knew all about sort of classical poetry. And I said, look, I'm not sure these are poems because I can't write a meter. And he said, no, they're fantastic. No one else is telling these stories about people. And you've got a sort of skill for narrative. And one day you'll get published. And I didn't kind of believe him. I got a few poems published, but it's quite hard. And then I'd linked up with this guy who's in a writing group who started a publishing press, Conversation Paper Press. So it's the link to the website is on the cards that I've got here. And David is just very interested in the poet as an activist, and he's very interested also in work of people from different countries who can't get published, and he's published work from people in Zimbabwe and in Turkey. And he approached me and he said, what we'd like is a collection of poems arising from your work with refugees. And so this is how this book arose, and it was published in March 2012. And I feel really lucky that my work's been validated by that. But also, I don't want to stop there. I've wanted to use the book very much as a tool to go out into the community and just tell people what's happening in a different way, you know, kind of through the arts. Anyway, enough about that. I'll stop reading some poems. So the first one is called The Moment of Crossing. I tried to do ones that kind of because there are all sorts in there, really, but I tried to do ones that maybe illustrated people's experience a little bit. So this one is about being released, and I was involved in the release, the moment of crossing. You had one bag which contained your world. We went through the gates. You told me how you'd torn up your documents, thrown them to the wind. They blew about the trousers of the guards. In the taxi, we saw the dark extending and all the lights of Dover. You could not believe your freedom. 3 long years without touching a girl, without beer. In the train, we passed through tunnels, stopped at a station where hundreds of students waited, young as you had been before. Then the sea at the edge of my town, black, full of mud and questions. So that was really about someone on the threshold, and people are so euphoric when they get out. He'd been in 20 months. Then when he got out and went to stay with a friend, they had a dispute between them. He had no money, he had no resources. He was drinking a little bit because he hadn't had a chance to do that in detention. And things were very difficult for him. Finally, he's had 3 years leave to remain as a stateless person. I managed to help him get a council flat. He's now met a girl. And I hope he gets an extension and gets another 3 years, you know. But it was a real struggle, and sometimes he would say, I just feel like jumping off the bridge, even if he was released. Because it's another kind of detention, really. He was moved from sort of more or less being homeless in Oxford to something that's called NAS accommodation, Home Office accommodation for people who are refused asylum seekers. People have to often share a room and exist on vouchers of £35 a week and have to report. And it's a very difficult life with very little hope. But we did get there. So the next poem is Reporting Centre. Because people have to do this terrible reporting to immigration reporting centres, they're quite often tagged like criminals electronically. You might go down there if you're someone's bail surety with them or a friend, and they go in, and you don't know if they're going to come out again. And it's so sad when you see the lines of people, you know, waiting outside and worrying. With this particular guy that stopped speaking because he became mute, I actually managed to wangle my way into going in with him. Usually you're not allowed to do that, but I managed to sort of negotiate that because of his mental illness and because of me with him. And on one particular day, they kept us there all day. We were the last people there, and I thought they were going to take him again. And he was saying, he was gearing himself up and saying, "I'm getting ready for a fight. You know, I'm gonna make their life hell if they take me." And I was feeling sick. And in the end, all they did was change his paperwork, but they just did it to torture me. So this is about that day. Reporting centre. I remember the white and black of that day. White posters, black print. The red doors, screens coming down, shutting off faces of workers, and us waiting. A man at the cubicle shouting, a man crying, white handkerchief fluttering. Men slumped, heads bowed, you with sweat on your brow. I remember the official in khaki with papers, leading us through the red door to a room without windows. A room without windows, screens coming down. And that's what it was like. It was really scary. Right, so the next one is kind of a little bit just hints at the effects of detention on people. And it's called I Didn't See the Rain. I had another Algerian client. Young man who used to phone me up all the time, just tell me the stories on the phone. They were really beautiful stories. I mean, these people are poets themselves. Actually, I feel the poems very much belong to them in a way. And it was all about this weird life he led. I don't know, he'd been involved in gambling, he was always in trouble with the police. And he very much thought about a house in Algeria that still remained, but he couldn't go back to because he wanted to go back to Algeria, actually, because there was nothing happening here for him. but they couldn't get a travel document. This is the situation with a lot of people. Even if they want to go back, they can't get the documents for them to go back, and yet they can't regularise their lives here. And so he told me this story by way of a conversation. So, I didn't see the rain. Long time I didn't see the rain in black November, my bad luck month. 5 years inside, I never felt the rain reach my skin, flooding me like punishment. I didn't see my sister's face in drops blown down. In 5 years, I forgot. Now out around the hustlers, the police, I see her in my father's house, made of shadow, made of cloud, in a place that cried for rain like this. I brought her up, just us. The rest had died or disappeared. I sent money from France and England. I learned to hustle, learned the casino, learned about women. But she was more to me. Cut and you find our blood, stronger than whiskey, hotter than chili, cooled only by rain of separation. Caught and locked, I forgot. Now she has a man in my father's house. I am out with the rain. This guy was very superstitious, you know, he really didn't like the rain because actually it had been raining on a bad day, November the day that he got detained. So that was kind of at the roots of that. So this, I did this course at the Refugee Therapy Centre and I kind of learned something about the experience of trauma, which is that everything is very much kind of fragmented. And often your memory, well, I think all memory is quite unreliable, but particularly with refugees, the memory is quite unreliable because people compartmentalise things. Often one area of the brain can't deal with something like torture or really awful traumatic experience. And then when you're having to tell it to a Home Office person, you might say it differently on different occasions, and then you're called a liar. So I was just trying to, in this poem, get at that kind of broken experience. Person's spirit not broken, but their life broken. The day is crying. Crossing the bridge, they came to find each other. They could not meet and reach a place of safety. There were doubts and explosions. There were explanations. He had no money. Someone had stolen the phone. When she called, it was not his voice, but a boy who said, "It's my phone. I have the phone 3 months." Crossing the bridge, they came towards each other. The boy sounded innocent. He said, "You mean the Iranian? I will tell him you called." Could she trust him to pass a message when all other messages were lost? He said, "My name is." How many names? How many times would she cover for him? That time in the street, his hand over hers, and the child on the bus he said he loved. In some places, they stop a bus and shoot the children. Crossing the bridge, they tried to reach each other. There was a bird who wanted to say. There was a boy who said, "I have the phone 3 months." There was a child destroyed because he could never cry. A bridge existed between two faiths, two countries. The bridge is broken. The day is crying, he said. Okay. Right, the next poem is called The Other Migrant. And I went to Morocco for this holiday. Usually I just go to Cornwall, I'm a bit of a coward, but I went to Morocco because I had actually connected with a lot of North African people through my work. And I thought, well, I have to go and see what it's like. Morocco is fairly safe compared to all the other countries which were in the middle of the revolution. So I stayed in this place, and there was this guy there, and he was the proprietor, and he was kind of really complaining about his life and how tough it was on him, you know, and how he wanted to get a job in England, and how hard it was, and how he was texting his mum and stuff, you know. And he was a nice guy, and he really looked after me during my stay, but it's quite, you know, it's so ironic that that kind of migrant is doing pretty well out of this situation, and that kind of migrant is okay. And well respected because they're making money, and there's another kind of migrant who's scapegoated and locked up and sometimes killed by deportation. So this is for Anthony, but he's a nice guy. The other migrants. In winter, it rains. Moroccans disappear under blankets. The stone walls of the Riad crack, and the bamboo roof of the souk, a welcome summer shade, makes a prison. He can't find the sky through the gate in the wall, Bab Bouajalou, and the square where taxis wait for occasional tourists. But the sky is sullen, clouds diffuse the earlier blue, caramel and pewter. Uncertainty runs wild like street cats. Deals depend on tips and bribes. I can make it work is the mantra. The walls must be pinned and made with plaster, smooth enough to hang the pictures of the king, smiling for new guests. There have been less since the bomb in Marrakesh. When it rains, he retreats to Café Clock with the expats, hugging his laptop, sampling a camel burger, sending a text to his mother in London as she walks the green parks, where one day his youngest girl will play. So that was him, you know, he had kind of more freedom of movement. So the final one is called The Cheering Rain. I kind of feel like in this world where you're trying to help refugees and migrants, and there's detention and immigration controls, everything is kind of back to front, you know, nothing is as you expected. It's a kind of nightmare world. And that phrase, the cheering rain, it just came from an experience when I went down to Birmingham to see an Algerian guy that I'd become a friend of. And we were really not getting on, and he was quite angry about something. And I was in this market in Birmingham, and I just felt like I was the one in another country, I was the alien. I kind of felt cast out and really upset because my intentions had been good. And I listened to the rain. I was really conscious of this rain, and it sounded like a crowd cheering. It sounded very malevolent and violent. And I was very upset, and I wrote this poem afterwards really about that experience. But it was just an instance in our friendship, and the whole thing wasn't like that. And then I really thought that was the right title poem for the book, because you don't expect the rain to be cheering. You don't expect the rain to be kind of cheerful. You expect the rain to be miserable. So it's part of that kind of back to front thing. A lot of people said, oh no, you can't go without title, you know, it's no, one will understand it. But anyway, I've explained it to you now. And when you hear the poem, you kind of might understand it. The cheering rain. Rain comes like a crowd cheering, hard on tarmac, on canvas. Everyone cheers with the rain. A boy runs between stalls to a van, parked in a side street at odd angles. A man laughs, selling baskets of old tomatoes, 50 pence because it's Ramadan. Rain comes loud, dousing the sultry hours of an August day. The rain is my unsteadiness. I could be swept away. The colours of vegetables flood, green and scarlet peppers, iridescent onions, humble brown potatoes. I scarcely see them. It's simpler to be with the rain, the thrill of its sound, like a crowd roaring, like somebody trampling. We shelter together. You say, I told you not to come at Ramadan. I make myself into a desert, a hard, dry place, safe from the passion of water and sacrifice. I cover my hair and listen to the cheering rain.
Okay, thank you very much for listening.
Here from a group who I used to volunteer with, Catherine Destiny, a third group. So do you want to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about, because you're very close to Brighton and some of your volunteers are from Brighton, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I work with Gatwick Detainees Welfare Group, and we are mainly volunteer-led, so we have about 80 volunteers across five different regions in Sussex. Our largest group, unsurprisingly, is in Brighton. We have about 30 volunteers in Brighton. And our volunteers visit people in detention once a week. So you visit the same person in either Brookhouse or Tinsley House until that person is released from detention or transferred to a different detention centre. I think for all the kind of the frustrating things that we've heard today about the system and visiting these very vulnerable people who find themselves victim of this crazy immigration and detention system that we have built up in the UK. For hearing about all that, I think visiting can be incredibly rewarding. So it's very inspiring and humbling visiting people who have suffered so much and yet kind of remain extremely dignified, and also it's very rewarding just meeting people that you would never normally perhaps meet in your everyday lives and building that kind of supportive relationship. So we are always looking for new volunteers. We have a system whereby we recruit, so if you are interested in becoming a volunteer, then you just need to contact us with your information. We put on a waiting list, so you can start straight away. But we would contact you when we begin recruiting again, and we'd start the ball rolling from there. So if you are interested, then you can contact us through email or phone, and just let us know.
If, for example, you've been in the MEP, I think even references for people who be part of the group, so if I know you, I would be more than happy to write references. I have done it before. I'm sure who is will take it seriously, my references, so, you know, just let me know if you... Yeah.
Any questions or observation about what we've seen or what we talked about?
I have a question. I don't know who should answer it. Why, you know, maybe the official reason or otherwise, why are people kept in detention for like a really long time? Because on the face of it, obviously, it doesn't really make any sense. You know, either they would be, you'd think they'd either be sent home or they would be allowed to be.
Dover is actually prison service. It's run by the prison service. Most of the other detention centres are private companies, and you know, it's roughly, is it £1,000 a week or something to keep people in detention?
100. It's 120 pounds per day, something like that. In 2010, in overall, it was around 8,497 £200. So it's around almost 9 million pounds,
yeah. Can I just say in relation to your question about why people are detained for so long, some of the people I supported were because maybe they find it quite difficult to prove their case. You have to prove your case, basically. Basically, they don't trust what you say. They don't believe you. So you have to convince the Home Office that, you know, you've been persecuted, or you know, I don't know, there are cases from sexuality to political activity, and it's very difficult to prove that. First of all, because you escape your country. When you escape your country, you're not packing your document away to say, oh, I'll use them later on, because they, you know, you don't know that. Lots of people think also that people are, lots of people are coming to UK because they can get benefits, you know, and most of people, they don't know about the benefit. They're coming from cultures where there is not such a benefit support. So look, I supported people that they didn't have documents, and because it took so long to find a document or piece of news to prove that they'd been persecuted, they were there. I met someone who was there for 6 years, and it was incredible.
In the terms of the law, it's actually supposed to be that removal is imminent.
Yes.
But it isn't, you know, quite often that's, and the Home Office will say it is.
Yeah, that's the word that is always used, is imminent, removal is imminent. And in our experience, we're seeing far more young people who've perhaps been through the care system, and as many people in care do, they get into trouble, at a young age find themselves with a criminal history, a criminal record, and then didn't even realise that they had an issue with immigration, find themselves in detention, and find themselves facing deportation to these countries that they have no links with, so they don't speak the language. We've visited people recently from DRC. Young men, 21-year-old, was returned 2 months ago to DRC. He'd left the country when he was 3 years old, been taken by his father. And he'd got into trouble and accumulated two sentences which exceeded 12 months. And he spent his 18 months in detention fighting his case. So people are going to remain in detention because they're going to fight till the bitter end. And the appeals process can be quite a lengthy, drawn-out process. But if you've got children here, or if the UK is the only country that you know, you're going to fight your case till the end, and that can take 2 to 3 years by the time
you... I imagine this is something that people, because I'm thinking myself here, that the general population don't know, I've realised, you know, in the sense that I would have just assumed that if someone had been here, you know, came here as a baby or a young child, and had been here like 20 years, that they would be... become citizens by default, you know, automatically somehow. So basically no one, you're saying that anyone that was illegally here for any age, any reason, and could be deported at any point, or they could have
indefinite leave to remain, so they hadn't yet become a British citizen. They would have been given indefinite leave to remain, but perhaps their social worker or they didn't have the money to then take the citizenship test and regularise their stay into a British citizen. Brooke House, where we work specifically, and Tinsley House is used more for asylum seekers, so so-called failed asylum seekers who come to the end of the line with their cases. They would tend to go to Tinsley House because it's a very different type of detention centre. Brooke House down the road is built on a Category B prison model, so it's much more high security. So the idea was that they would detain people post-prison sentence. But actually, we do see people who have just come into the UK, and they find themselves in Brooke House, which is a really hideous environment to be in if you're traumatised. But I think asylum has become criminalised. We've criminalised the asylum system. And as Kate said, you know, people become destitute once their asylum claim fails. I can say specifically about Brooke House and Tinsley House at Gatwick. I'm not quite sure about the conditions at Dover. I think they're similar to Brooke House. There are varying degrees of security across the detention state. And Brooke House, as with Colmar in London, and I think Dover, are the higher security centres whereby there's restricted movement between the wings. So Brooke House is built as like a H block, and there's four different wings and a central activities block, and people are put on a wing and they're expected to share a room with one other person, and they're cells, so they look like prison cells. They're designed to be uncomfortable. And people are locked into their cell from 9 o'clock at night till 8 o'clock in the morning. And then they lock them into their room again from midday till 12:30 before lunch to do like a bowl call. And again before dinner. And if anything happens to go wrong in the centre, if there's a fight or anything, those detainees will go onto lockdown. So the whole centre will go on lockdown, and people might spend several hours locked into their rooms. And people tell us that they feel incredibly claustrophobic in Brooke House, particularly if somebody's been tortured in prison. So at the moment we're seeing a lot of Sri Lankans, Tamil, who have been tortured and then find themselves in this kind of prison-like environment, which naturally stirs up trauma that they experienced in prison. So the environment that is holding them is often a big cause of their psychological issues.
Yeah. And are they offered any type of therapy or, you know, any counselling sessions for that?
There's nothing available to them in terms of mental health support.
They have a medical centre in Brookhouse, in all detention centres there'll be a medical centre, but in Brookhouse there is no formal psychological support. In Tinsley House there was a visiting psychologist from the local Pleasanton, but she wouldn't work in Brookhouse because the environment was just such that she couldn't do any effective work. Because the environment is such that will have, you know, the impact psychologically, she won't go and work in there.
And in terms of who they're placing themselves with, is that considered in terms of cultures, in terms of religion, or do they just stick two people in and don't?
I think they say that management of Brookhouse, who are G4S, which is a private company, they say that they do take into consideration who they put together in a cell, but I think in reality, you know, the logistics of that is going to be a nightmare. So people do find themselves sharing, you know, I met an asthmatic Iranian last week who was put in with a 40 a day smoker, and when you're locked into a really small room with somebody, health-wise, it's not good, and also being put into a room with somebody you can't communicate with, and also, you know, different people from different countries, from different tribes or ethnic groups. Which,
I believe the conditions in Brookhouse are becoming a bit worse because I've been told that now they cannot have newspapers that they are not from England. So I was told, I spoke to Nick about that. So they cannot read about what is happening in the EU countries. When they go into internet, many websites are blocked. So they might not be able to know what is happening in some places. I've been also told now that they are not allowed to have two telephones, which I need something, I sent an email about that. One telephone, they might have the one with for making the phone calls in the UK and the other phone to make the phone calls from another country. And I was told last week they went into some people's rooms and they took the second one of the phones without giving them time to save numbers and things like that. So in Brookhouse, since I've been going there for 3 years now, I can see the conditions are getting worse. It's becoming much more limit in what they can do, much more limit in what they can do too. Absolutely everything is changing for worse. I don't know what you think.
I mean, the conditions have always been pretty poor. I think one of the main complaints we get is the restrictions on websites and stuff. If you're in detention, you're representing yourself in your legal case, which so many people are, you need access to information, and that's very restricted. So they can't access the Home Office website to get recent case law, or the High Court website to get information to build their case. I suppose, you know, cynically, you would think that it's to prevent people being able to progress their case. Our website is blocked. I mean, you know, we're a charity, the visitors group. We don't have any sort of or too much damning information on there, but we're blocked. Any kind of website that could be seen to be useful is blocked. So
is that? I mean, it feels a bit like that can't really be legal. Is it just that it's not been challenged? Is there other actual laws that say it's okay for them to do that, or how does it work?
We did approach Liberty about that in the past, and that's a problem across the detention estate. So it's not specific to the centre that we work in.
But there's all this issue about legality and illegality, what you define, and also the fact that you're not from this country, so no one will represent you until the end. Do you know what I mean? You're living in this kind of no man's lands in a way, isn't it? It's very difficult because you're not British. So you're in a British land, yeah, but you're not British, so no one would be prepared to defend your rights. I find lots of people that are really stranded. So your country will not represent you because you're actually making a claim against your country, you know, you've been persecuted or whatever. This country doesn't believe you. Do you know what I mean? You basically, no one cares about you, and then it's all been privatised. Private company can do whatever they want, and the one that ran in the detention centre, you know, they're really, really bad. By the way, they won a huge contract with the Olympics now. So we're maintaining the best in a way. With
they're subject to UK and EC law. They're not, I mean, they can't do what they want. I mean, at all. It's in the, they're in the UK.
But they're not accountable. This is the problem. They lie.
People used to get beaten up when they get transferred from one detention, or they get taken from the detention to the plane, to the airport. They used to get beaten up on the van, yeah? Reported case, you know, it's not like we're making it up. And there was a big battle, legal battle, to put CCTV camera in the van, minivan, so, you know, to protect people. But at one point it was just like, we can do whatever we want. And it's just, it was literally at one point, we was very, like, incredible.
Was it last year or the year before somebody was killed?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. Jimmy was killed. And still we are waiting to hear about what the court is saying, isn't it, about pointing out. The only thing that happened with that is, like, G4S is not anymore. He lost a contract to escort people on the deportation flights, and now is Reliance. And supposedly Reliance is using less mortal techniques.
So if you need any more volunteers, get on the website. It's an amazing experience. Be ready for it. And thank you so much for Assumption to organise this.
No, thank you for coming, really.
And thank you to Refugee Venue for coordinating.
You've been listening to the Refugee Radio programme. Our programme today featured a reading of a poetry by the writer and activist Kate Adams, and a discussion with members of the public and some people who volunteered as visitors of immigration detainees. If you want to get involved, or if you want to find out more about volunteering with visiting people in detention, the Gatwick Detainees Welfare Group website is www.gdwg.org.uk. If you want to find out more about Kate Adams' book Cheering Rain and maybe order yourself a copy, I certainly would recommend it. The website is www.conversationpoetry.co.uk, and Conversation Poetry are the people who published the book. It's called The Cheering Rain, and if you have a look at the Conversation Poetry website, you'll see a link there to The Cheering Rain. Kate Adams volunteers for a group called Kent Refugee Help. And if you want to get some more information about Kent Refugee Help, or perhaps make a donation to them, their website is www.kentrefugeehelp.org.uk. Thank you for listening.